You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā nā koutou katoa, ko Thomas toku ingoa, nō mai hari mai ki te wire mō tēnē rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for the Rahine Monday. I'm your host Thomas and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in studio by News Director Kasta. E whai aki nei coming up on the show, I spoke to Dr. Justin Sobion from the University of Auckland Law School about the government's attempted climate law change and how it goes against the International Court of Justice's recommendations. And I talked to University of Auckland Professor of Commercial Law, Gehan Gunasekera, about the Police Amendment Bill and how it could diminish privacy rights. Kasta, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I asked about the government's stance on immigration amidst a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment overseas. I also spoke to Director of Wellbeing, System Leadership, Data and Insights at Te Heringa Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Dr. Eric Ala Cullen, about plans for a social media ban in New Zealand as results emerge from the ban in Australia. And I spoke to Ben Wright from Lobbying Reform NZ about a recent petition the organisation has put to government asking for more transparency around lobbying.
He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pai tuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waia mai rane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e ware ware e ahe ana kotu te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he pakeheri roki roki ma runga i te pai, tukutuko o ere rangi poho, me hariki 95BFM erekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get on with the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Recent weeks have seen the government adopting a series of policies targeted at immigration. Some of these policies are set to be introduced immediately, while others are proposals for the upcoming election. What all of these policies have in common is that they aim to respond to an idea that there is a subset of immigrants who are making society in New Zealand worse. This is a narrative we've seen dominate conversations about immigration overseas, particularly in the United States, United Kingdom, and Australia. It often leads to gross displays of racism, with mass riots and crackdowns on people who have done nothing wrong. With these recent policies and media attention towards anti-immigrant rhetoric in Aotearoa this month, concerns have been raised over whether those overseas developments could be seen here. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court, I plan to ask about both immigration and the move-on orders for rough sleepers, though we ran out of time to discuss both. I began by asking Simon about the government's recent stance on immigration. Today, I want to talk about immigration. The government's recently announced a bunch of policies looking at immigration coming from National ACT and New Zealand First. Certainly more than we've seen earlier in the government's term. What do you think the reason is for this sudden increase in policy announcements around immigration?
Well, New Zealanders have always welcomed immigrants. You know, we've welcomed them into our communities, into our businesses. As a civil engineer, I've never worked on a project anywhere where there haven't been people from around the world and from different cultures. And that actually leads to a greater diversity of thought and it makes New Zealand a stronger country. But over the past few years, our trust and confidence in the immigration system has been called into question. Obviously, during COVID, the borders were closed, people couldn't come and go. And at that time, the Labor government offered over 200,000 people who were here on temporary visas, and that usually means people come and work and they go back to their home country. If they want to come back, they've got to reapply, offered them a pathway to permanent residency. And so that's meant that overnight, rather than the 30 to 40,000 permanent residents that we might gain every year, we had 200,000. And it's that, and I think combined with a lot of concern we've seen overseas in Australia, the UK, the US about uncontrolled immigration, which we don't have in New Zealand, it's created a sense that we do need to get to grips with it and make sure we've got policies that are fit for the Kiwis who live here now.
And ACT's big policy has been the six-point plan to deal with immigration. Can you talk about what that six-point plan is, what the contents are, and what people could expect from it?
Well, skilled visas for skilled jobs. We've got to have employer visa categories that are fit for purpose. And at the moment, those categories are only reassessed as to whether we still need those type of workers every 3 years. Actually, we need to do it annually, because it may well be that in one particular year, we need a lot of specialised dairy farm workers who know how to operate equipment. But if we have a couple of quiet years in dairy, maybe we don't need to bring in quite so many. So making sure that the number of visas that we allocate to particular skills is reviewed annually, that doesn't mean that people only get a one-year visa. It means that government has to do its part annually. We're also going to impose, if ACT's policies are taken up by the next government, a $6 per day infrastructure surcharge on temporary work visas, which would raise around $80 million a year. And if you live in Auckland, you know, there's a lot of people come here. It's a great city to live in. But yeah, our infrastructure is under pressure, whether it's stormwater or wastewater, and, of course, traffic. So we think, look, there's a couple of things that we think will make a big difference. But there's a downside to some issues around immigration, and that is we've seen, particularly with some really serious and violent offenders, that we can't send them back to their country of origin once they've been convicted and sentenced and done their time in New Zealand prisons. And that's because after you've been here for a certain amount of time, current New Zealand law says you can't be deported. What ACT is saying is if you get sentenced to more than 10 years in prison or more, you can be deported regardless of how long you've been in New Zealand.
And this is joining the current context of the government also announcing the Immigration Enhanced Risk Management Amendment Bill, which, among other things, will be allowing officers to question suspected overstayers without any evidence of them overstaying already. This has been criticised by some who have compared it to ICE raids we're seeing in the United States, some of New Zealand's own history where we saw Dawn raids. How would you respond to that criticism? I mean, it seems like the government is taking quite a harsh stance on immigration here.
Well, calling overstayers ICE raids is absurd. We've always had immigration laws, and enforcing them is a normal function of government. We've heard the Greens talking about ICE raids. They sound like they're keen to import foreign culture wars by accusing, you know, the government of basically carrying out normal functions. And of course, any police officer can stop and ask you what you're doing, and please provide identification if they suspect an individual of doing something unlawful. And you know, immigration officers are no different. So I absolutely reject the sense that this is some kind of ICE raid.
You mentioned importing foreign culture wars there, and earlier you also mentioned concerns we're seeing overseas about immigration in Australia, the UK and the US, and certainly these policies seem to be mirroring some of those concerns. We're seeing overseas where people are raising a lot of fear around immigration and high immigration numbers. There's a worry that these policies are tying into some of that sentiment we're seeing develop in New Zealand, some very harsh anti-immigrant sentiment that the ACT Party itself called out when we saw Shane Jones saying similar stuff about our Indian migrants to New Zealand. I guess my worry here is that even though these policies may be coming from a place that is good of heart, is it not contributing to these ideas that are very harsh towards our immigrants who have been here for a very long time and who continue to contribute to making Aotearoa a better place?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. We're all immigrants. We all came here by waka, sailing ship, aeroplane, all of us. All we're descended from people who were very courageous and took that journey to what is still the furthest place you can go on Earth to try to get a job, you know, unless you're going to Antarctica and you're a scientist. So it's really, really important that any changes to the immigration system reinforce our respect for the people who've chosen to come here, the value that they bring, but also makes it clear that New Zealand does have the right to create rules around immigration that maintain confidence in the immigration system. Because I think what we've seen overseas, and you know, I was in the US recently and travelled down to the Mexican border, and you know, saw the wall, saw border control enforcement in action. Yeah, that they have stopped 100,000 people a month coming across their southern border who are entering the United States illegally. Now, if you live near that southern border and 100,000 people marching past or heading away from the border in pickup trucks every month, it creates a great sense of unease and fear. We don't have that here, and there's no sense that New Zealanders are experiencing that level of concern. But what they are telling us is, look, we want to make sure that everyone who comes here is coming here for the right reason. They've got the right skills to match to the job that that apparently is needed to be filled, and that while they're here, they contribute to infrastructure that they need to use, the extra infrastructure we need to build, so we don't end up in a situation like we did some time ago with, you know, a whole lot of immigrants coming to New Zealand and not enough homes for them to live in and not enough infrastructure to support those homes. And, of course, for people who commit serious crimes, you know, on your bike, and get it, you don't get to be a resident of New Zealand. So I think ACT is certainly taking a constructive role when it comes to immigration, addressing people's genuine concerns, New Zealanders' genuine concerns, including some recent migrants who've got their citizenship and saying, I'm not entirely sure I like the way the immigration settings have drifted over the past few years. And of course, you know, we have to assess the fact and respond to the fact that many New Zealanders are looking at what's happening overseas and saying we wouldn't want it to happen here.
I think the big thing that I'm having trouble with is you're talking about this as if it's coming from New Zealand concerns, and you criticise the Green Party for doing some of what you said was bringing overseas culture war stuff to New Zealand. I find that very hard to, I guess, grapple with, because immigration, I mean, polling shows that it's not a top 10 concern for New Zealand voters in the latest Ipsos survey. It's not a big deal here as it is in the countries you mentioned, Australia, the UK, US, where we see massive protests anti-immigration and pro-immigration. My concern is that we're bringing this culture war here to a country that has historically not had these strong stances on immigration. The ACT Party, certainly, as a historically libertarian party, has been pro-immigration and pro-reducing restrictions on immigration. I'm struggling to understand why we're doing this right now. It seems like an important issue.
Well, ACT has not changed its stance. We are a political party that welcomes immigrants, and we recognise not just the value of all of those people who have immigrated to New Zealand and their descendants in the past, but the ones who continue to come. I think what's important, though, is that when people immigrate to New Zealand, they are conscious that if they consider committing a serious offence and it has a sentence of more than 10 years in prison, we're talking about things like, you know, attempted murder, rape, and other things, they can be sent out of the country. I don't think any immigrant here lawfully would disagree with that. That skilled visas for skilled jobs, that we actually, the government's role is to make sure that for the visas that are available to be filled every year, actually match the skills need in the economy. They are entirely reasonable things to apply to improve the existing immigration system. And again, the infrastructure surcharge. Anyone who's lived in Auckland for the past decade or so and seen the struggle to build housing and to provide infrastructure to catch up with the immigration surge that we've seen. You know, people want to come and live in our beautiful city. They understand $6 a day, that $80 million a year that we could raise across the country, that is going to contribute to funding the vital infrastructure that we need.
All right, that's all I've got prepared for today. Sorry we ran out of time for the other topic, but thank you as always for the interview.
Oh, you're welcome, Kester. And look, it is a really important and sensitive issue, and that's why, you know, we want to make sure that we're responding to the actual problems, not responding to emotional responses to what we've seen on social media overseas. And so, I feel we're on the right track, but of course voters will be the judge.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking about the government's stance on immigration amidst a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment overseas.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be back after a short break. This is Poho Kereru by Silas Future.
Trying to be a figure to my far, no, they can count on. Thousand voices in my head debating where I fell off. Other thousands saying, bruv, how you fall before you even started. Keep on marching, tell your people that it's on, cause it's on. My Hurangi boy going off on the songs. Cut Hurangi boy, keep it all to himself. When am I gonna stress? So I got to the death. Wear that tie on my chest. Early morning on top of the new week. These days I don't trust it, even if you offer it to me. Too many false flags and high hopes. Burn out on people throwing smoke screens, bluffs, and tight ropes. So I keep my friends closer than my enemies. They say it never made sense, could be the death of me. The city gets the best, even of the strong survivors. While my home is what it is, gives me my energy. Big mana, mana. Foundation, run deep, keep it 100. Keep my family close, if you know me, you know. That's why I bring them every time I put down at the show. Matter of fact, if you see me, you best believe I'm in a whole different season. I'm trying to open up the limitations of my being. I'm not playing, so ain't no game that I compete in. Fuck up, I'm on the record, so you know that when I say this, the best thing going, I really mean it. Sight so cold, the headphones keep freezing. Let me pull whole kid to do right now. I'm representing mine now. What?
Giveaway of your Wellington dreams has just dropped. 95BFM are giving away flights, accommodation and tickets to Loomis Festival to one lucky B-card holder. Stay tuned to 95BFM Breakfast for the chance to head to this extravaganza of music, art and culture happening in Wellington this June. The winner will be drawn Tuesday, May 19th. Loomis Festival from June 9th to 21st in Wellington. For all details and tickets, head to loomis.nz.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again, or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow! Go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse! Headway wins the Spring Cup!
Oh, no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball-playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport, too.
Pony Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashdowns, candid conversation, cheap shots and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m, only on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Ah.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Last week, the government announced it would amend climate laws to prevent companies from being sued over damage caused by greenhouse gas emissions. The change will prevent findings of liability in torts and would apply to current and future cases. The amendment is in response to a case against Fonterra made by iwi leader and activist Mike Smith, who was not seeking any financial damages but felt it was in the public's interest to have the company held liable. The Supreme Court granted Smith the right to pursue the case, raising questions if this government action is going around the courts and breaching democratic checks and balances. These changes will directly go against International Court of Justice opinion, which confirmed countries have a duty to prevent significant harm to the environment and to regulate the activities of companies within their jurisdiction. To discuss the repercussions of this climate law change, I talked to Dr. Justin Sobion from the University of Auckland Law School. Can you just give a bit of an explanation of why this government decision to change climate law and torts is so controversial?
Yeah, it's controversial to the extent that the general trend, I would say, the general movement, I would say, especially coming out of the COVID era in this decade, is towards climate justice, climate emergencies, and getting on top of what we the UN has labeled a triple planetary crisis, which is climate change, biodiversity loss, and pervasive pollution. And now this movement has started even back in the 70s when you speak about the first Earth Day in 1971 with the formation or establishment of Greenpeace. But I think as we've reached the pinnacle of this mountain we've been trying to climb, which is climate awareness and climate justice. And it has been seen within the last 5 years where we've had three advisory opinions on climate change from three well-established, respected international tribunals, and that is the Inter-American Court on Human Rights and the International Tribunal for Law of the Sea, and lastly with the International Court of Justice. So states, all these tribunals have been saying, just as what IPCC science has been saying, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN scientific body, they have been saying that states, we need to be more ambitious. We need to cut greenhouse gases by the end of this decade, by 2030, if we want to reach that 1.5 degrees centigrade increase in temperature goal. So we need to be ambitious. We need to move forward on the climate agenda. So I think this particular legislation goes contrary to that, to this movement that we've been having. So that's why I think it becomes very controversial, given the climate that we are in, no pun intended, yeah.
And this law change in particular, kind of self-admitted by the government, is in regards to the Mike Smith case against Fonterra. And Supreme Court gave permission for that case to go ahead. Do you think it potentially sets a bit of a dangerous precedent of the government going over the top of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think I would like to think so, because here we have the Supreme Court. Now, mind you, the trial of Smith hasn't even started yet, right? We are still going through the preliminary motions of the case. Of course, Fonterra, the respondents, they wanted to strike out his claim. So the trial hasn't even started yet. And the Supreme Court has said, after it went, they tried to strike out a certain claim, essentially trying to strike out the whole claim with the tort, with respect to tort and climate change law. The Supreme Court says Smith has a good has to have his day in court. Let us put forward. We are not going to stymie the tort, broadening of the scope of tort to climate change law. That's something that a trial judge should do, right? Let's hear the case on its merits. And I understand it's going to be listed for April next year, 2027. That's my understanding. I could be wrong, but I think it's around then. So what we're trying to say is that no matter who wins this case at the High Court, if it's Smith, if it's Fonterra and others, it's going to be appealed to the Court of Appeal, right? That will take maybe another, I don't know, 6 months to a year. And no matter who wins at the Court of Appeal, it's going to be appealed to the Supreme Court, right? That will be another 6 to 9 months, maybe a year. So we are looking at maybe, at best, almost 3 years of further litigation, right? And I think that is what I think lawmakers need to be concerned about or worry about, is that let the law develop and take its course. We're not going to get a decision in Smith and Fonterra, a final decision tomorrow, right? So you should not I would think the executive branch, the legislative branch of parliament should not do anything to stymie an action that will probably take, you're looking at 3 to 4 years from now, right? And it's not to say, okay, we're going to take future actions, which is still a problem for me, but you're saying we're going to do this retroactively, right? So it would affect Smith's case. We all know this is about Smith and Fonterra. And if you can affect one, a case that is currently going on, think about possible cases that could have come through the pipeline because of this particular legislation. So that's why I think that the Supreme Court, being the highest court in New Zealand, that ought to be respected, what they said. Let the law take its course and let it go through the judicial system and not without any undue interference and separation of powers. So that's my take on it, I think, yeah.
You mentioned that it's going to be done retrospectively. Is that really unusual for a law change to be done like that to court cases?
Well, no, there is legislation that applies retroactively in the past, to current cases. There is law, but when you do that, with a sense of having collaborative talks. You do that, you get some feedback from the public, it runs through a certain motion within the parliament, so it has to be urgent, right? Now, we are saying this is not urgent, right? Because it's going to, Smith and Fonterra, as I said, it's going to take quite a long time for this matter to be decided in the Supreme Court, because as you said, it's such an important case. It's going to take quite a long time. It's going to be appealed to the Supreme Court. So we are saying that you need to be a bit, let the law run its course, let it be a transparent process. And we do not think that, I do not think that this particular legislation warrants a retroactive type of feature or format. I certainly do not think so.
And another potential precedent being set, are you concerned that the government isn't aligning with the ICJ on this issue?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the main point. New Zealand was one of the core supporters of Vanuatu's initiative to take International Court of Justice, to take climate change to the International Court of Justice. So they were fully behind or supporting Vanuatu in this cause as a one of the, if I were to say, the bigger brother or sister of the Pacific region. And then we had Australia coming on afterwards. But New Zealand was clear out the line from the beginning. And the ICJ actually said that states have an obligation to protect the climate system. And they even went so far to say that states also have an obligation to regulate companies who actually operate within their jurisdiction to ensure that those companies do not produce greenhouse gases, do not use the atmosphere as their dumping ground, do not cause any damage to the climate system. So it's not only the government, the state has to protect the climate system, but also the state has to ensure that others who operate, including multinational corporations, the ICJ is clear on that, right? Because you're inviting these multinational corporations, or maybe companies, your own local companies, if that's the case, and you have to ensure that they comply with the international law obligations as handed down by the International Court of Justice. So we see that passing that legislation would be totally against the advice of the International Court of Justice. Now, I say against the advice because we all know the ICJ advisory opinion is what it is. It's an opinion of the court. We have asked the court a certain question, and the court has given us an opinion. So it goes against one of the highest court of the world, the highest tribunal. That's the cream of the crop. You can't get higher than that, right, in terms of jurisprudence and international law. So, yeah, and what I'm really watching at now, actually, I actually had a word with some of my colleagues in Vanuatu at the United Nations in New York. This week, actually on Wednesday, the 22nd, there's a resolution that is going to be tabled at the United Nations where states are being called upon to implement to recognize and to implement the decision of the ICJ at the Hague. So I think I'm keenly observing to see how New Zealand would vote on that. So, right now I understand the government hasn't laid a formal position as yet for my colleagues back in New York who are working the case. But we are keenly waiting to see how New Zealand would vote on that particular resolution. So if, for example, they vote yes, they would wish to implement and to recognize that advisory court, that International Court of Justice advisory opinion. I think that would well be contrary to their domestic plans to be tabled at the Parliament.
That was Dr. Justin Sobion from the University of Auckland Law School speaking to me about the government's climate change law changes and their potential repercussions.
Well, my favourite BFM ad is Fuck Knuckles, Cock and Piss.
The Wire.
Public submissions for the Policing Amendment Bill are currently being made, and a number of privacy concerns have been raised. The bill is split into two parts, with the first focusing on intelligence gathering and the second giving police new powers to declare a wider range of public areas off limits. The impact of the first part on privacy rights in particular has been up for debate, as new changes would allow police to take photos and record in public with a much lower bar of justification, and are not required to provide a right to access or deletion. Originally, police were forced to stop taking photos by the courts, unless figures were directly related to the case, after it was revealed in 2020 that they had been taking photos of tens of thousands of people not suspected of any crime, the majority of which were Māori youth. To discuss the Policing Amendment Bill and its potential privacy impacts, I talked to University of Auckland Professor of Commercial Law, Gehen Gunasekera. Can you give us a brief overview of some of the concerns about this Policing Amendment Act?
So part one, for the benefit of your listeners, it says that the police can now take photographs for a wider range of purposes. The government's argument is that the police have always had this power, and somehow it's been taken away by the courts and privacy regulators, and they want to basically put the law back to where it was. Now, I take exception to that, and I don't agree with that interpretation. I think that the existing law was working quite well as interpreted by the courts, and unfortunately, this law will now broaden the powers that the police have to capture images and capture other associated information about people. So let me just begin by dispelling a very common misunderstanding here that, you know, they say, oh, the police can see everything that goes on in public and in a public place. Any member of the public, you and I, can snap a picture in a public place of a person. We shouldn't really be doing that unless, you know, we get permission from people. But leaving that aside, the argument is, oh, if your members of the public can see things happening, they can take photographs. Well, the police should be able to take photographs too. But there's a huge difference between ordinary members of the public, people like you and I, taking a photograph in public, and the police doing it. Because if the police take that photograph, it goes into one of their police information management systems. It goes into a database, and with facial recognition technologies now, that can instantly be identified. It can be compared with databases the police have, perhaps, of criminals and other associated people that are of interest. And it can potentially stay on that database for years. And one day, it might be used subtly to say, oh, you know, we think you're a person that we want to arrest. And so it could lead to the person being arrested or perhaps denied a job if the police are asked for a vetting. To vet a person, as is often the case when you apply for a job, you have to authorize the employer to access the police criminal database. And the database may not show that the person has a conviction. It might just show that, yes, this person's photo was taken, you know, standing next to someone who is a known criminal or something like that. And then, you know, you, in this country, we should be innocent until proven guilty. And my concern is that these images could end up in the wrong hands, and they could end up blighting people's careers and so on. So that's my fear. So this broadens the powers of the police to take pictures for very widely defined purposes. And they're defined as things like the integrity of policing. Another one is quote-unquote intelligence or other lawful purposes. Now, they don't define what intelligence is. So that's essentially anything that the police thinks might be of interest to them. Now, the difference is that the existing law, before this amendment bill was introduced, does allow the police to take images of people when they are detaining them, when they're arresting them, and in the context of a current investigation. But after the investigation ends, and after if the arrest doesn't end up with a conviction, that image has to be, under the existing law, deleted. There is no right to deletion in this new amendment bill. So that, you can see my concerns are that New Zealand law doesn't have a right to deletion. It doesn't have a right to erasure. And some of this data could live in the police databases for years. And who knows where it could go. It might end up, we have people talking about the United States border control authorities wanting access to New Zealand law data, law enforcement databases, in order for New Zealanders to get visa-free entry to the United States. Now, if that happens and biometric photographs, for example, are accessed and copied, then those images could end up in the databases of big companies like Clearview that, you know, makes a business out of capturing and selling people's images. And, you know, and that's a big global privacy risk. So all up, I think that the bill is overly wide. And I just think, I mean, I'm totally opposed to it, but if it goes ahead, then there needs to be a whole lot of additional safeguards defining what these things purposes are, including a right to access and correct that information and to check that it's been deleted. So those are, in a nutshell, my concerns.
There's been a particular worry of the disproportionate impact this could have on Māori. In 2020, it was revealed police were, kind of doing similar. They were taking tens of thousands of photos, and the majority were Māori youth who weren't suspected of a crime. With a lack of Māori consultation in the creation of this bill, is this something to be concerned about?
Yeah. So that's the other concern. So under the existing, so when I looked at the bill and it simply talked about or other lawful purposes, I was sort of compelled to look at what the existing purposes of the policing, what the existing purposes are as defined in the Policing Act. And they have things like, for this is in Section 9 of the existing Policing Act, the community support and reassurance. Now, the whole point of community support and reassurance is that you want the members of the community to actually support what the police are doing and take them along with you. This is what's called policing by consent. But what had been happening prior to that is some communities, especially Māori and Pacific communities, you know, the rangatahi, Māori youth had been the target of a disproportionate amount of image capture by the police. And that was criticized in an earlier report by the Independent Police Complaints Authority and the Privacy Commissioner. It was what's called the Joint Investigation Report, where they said that thousands of photographs had been taken. There was a disproportionate targeting of certain ethnicities. And of course, what that leads to is losing the support of that community, because, you know, if the police mission is meant to be community support and reassurance, putting people under surveillance and perhaps intimidating them by taking photographs can be counterproductive, because that kind of, it's a them and us kind of mentality. And the danger with this is that if a certain group is surveilled more than any other group, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because, you know, then that group is more likely to be detained, it's more likely to be convicted, because simply because they've got more evidence of where those people's movements are. So, if you know, you have two groups of people, one lot of people hardly get photographed, the other lot of people get photographed a lot. The crimes are committed, the police might be able to catch the people who have had more photos taken more easily. That doesn't mean that the first group haven't committed any crimes. It's just harder to catch them because their photos haven't been taken. So then you get the self-fulfilling prophecy of preventive, preventive crime prevention, but it becomes almost like the movie, the famous sci-fi movie Minority Report, where, if you remember, in that movie, Tom Cruise, he stars in that movie, and the mission of the police there is to catch people before they commit a crime, and then, of course, they get convicted before they even do anything.
Now, that is, you know, offends any sense of decency and any sense of fairness in our legal system, where you are innocent until proven guilty. So, you know, these are all things that I have, you know, there's the disproportionate targeting of certain communities, the potential for losing community support amongst those communities. And also the other concern I have is there's power for police now to film and take images in on private property if they were lawfully on private property. So this is potentially chilling. So if you think about police attending a protest meeting, for example, or they might be even attending a religious a commemoration of some kind, church service or something like that, and they're allowed to now film. Now, of course, that could put a chill on what people are saying, because, as I said, if you and I are filming something, that's fine, but if the police are filming something and it's known that the police are filming, then people are going to be careful what they say, and I think that that's an unreasonable imposition on people's freedoms.
With all of these issues that you've identified, the bill's currently in the select committee phase, are you hopeful that your submissions will be listened to and some changes might be made?
I am not, I'm not optimistic, but I am hopeful. And I think I did get a fair hearing, as others did in the select committee process. And to be fair, the members of the select committee across all parties, were striving to try and understand what the risks were and how to define intelligence and so on. So I look forward to seeing what they come up with. I honestly don't expect the bill to be knocked off or derailed completely, but I sincerely hope that the committee recommends, you know, at least certain safeguards. And the bottom lines, as I said, is, you know, people need to be able to have access, the ability to access those images, and not to have sort of broad law enforcement exceptions that would allow the police to say, no, sorry, we can't tell you what we're doing, or we can't give you access. That's simply not on. I think all the rights in the Privacy Act should apply. And also, I think that there should be some right to ensure that it's been audited and that images that are no longer relevant are deleted. I think, you know, there needs to be audit powers and there needs to be some kind of right to deletion as well.
That was University of Auckland Professor of Commercial Law, Gehan Gunaskerda, speaking to me about the Policing Amendment Bill and its potential privacy impacts.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
At the end of last year, Australia introduced a ban on social media use for those under the age of 16. While the policy was discussed across the globe in multiple countries, Australia was one of the first to actually introduce it. New Zealand is also one of the countries looking at introducing its own social media ban, despite a growing amount of evidence that the bans are ineffective. Young people are not only often resourceful enough to dodge the ban, but often the most significant causes of mental harm and distress run much deeper than just social media content. With New Zealand announcing a pause to the development of our own social media ban policy on Thursday last week, I spoke on Friday, the day after, to Director of Wellbeing, System Leadership, Data and Insights at Te Heringa Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Dr. Era Ella Cullen. And a lot of the stuff we're going to be discussing today is around the social media ban. And we've seen talks about social media bans developing internationally. We've seen some of those talks developing here as well. How are our talks about a social media ban in New Zealand influenced by those movements in other countries?
Yeah, look, that's a really good point. I mean, and observation. So as you said, there is a lot of movement internationally on this, and with Australia being the first country internationally to actually implement a ban, we think that, yeah, there's definitely been an influencing factor. And what's underneath all of that is a kind of global rise in psychological distress among young people. So this is, I guess, one solution that decision makers are seeing as the way forward.
And what are the motives around the big push for a social media ban or social media restrictions in New Zealand in particular?
I guess it really depends who you ask, and I will just say the one voice that is missing here are the voices of young people. So I guess the big push is there's some numbers out there. So as I said before, there is this very large increase in high to very high levels of psychological distress among young people. So that's something that's very, very sort of topical. The other thing is young people in New Zealand have some of the highest engagement on social media in the world. So, and it's not a bad thing. It's just what it is. Young people are spending a lot more time online. So that's another concern, I guess. And again, it depends who you ask. There is a view, a very dominant voice and view at the moment that social media is causing psychological distress among young people. And our position on that is that it's actually not a cause. So there's a lot of debate around basically whether removing social media from young people's lives will reverse the, you know, distress rates among young people and will deal with some of the issues that you can see in the media around the link between mental health or mental illness and the use of social media. So, yeah, there's a lot in there. It's quite complex. We think that social media is not the sole cause of youth mental distress. It acts more like an amplifier of existing offline issues, and it has both benefits and harms.
You mentioned that, I guess, link between social media and the harms that young people are facing, and that link is really difficult to establish, right, whether it exists or doesn't exist, because it's really difficult to gather evidence. Obviously, it's early days of the policy in Australia, but are there any teachings, are there any insights we're getting out of the policy as it's been enacted there thus far?
As you said, it's very, very early days. It's actually quite hard to say whether there has been any impact on youth mental health as a result of the ban. Sort of preliminary data does say that it's actually not working very well, and we know that because we've looked at the research and it's there. It says that these kinds of bans are actually quite easy to circumvent. It actually pushes people to less regulated spaces and can reduce access to support and connection, which is what young people need. So it is quite early to say whether the Australian ban has worked. Young people are still using social media in Australia, so 16-year-olds are still able to access social media. And there's basically a number of studies that are looking at the success of the bill in Australia, but it is actually quite hard to say right now. It's been 6 months, I think, since the ban in Australia. So we do need to just wait and see what happens. And that's our position on that. And it was quite good to see that RNZ article this morning after the Parliament debate on Wednesday that it is on hold. So that is a good thing to see because we should be waiting, we should be learning from Australia and we shouldn't be rushing.
You mentioned that social media can act as an amplifier for these other issues that young people are facing in either creating more mental harm or maybe doing the opposite as well. What are those other issues, and maybe are there any other government pathways that they could be looking into to address these issues rather than just looking at social media?
Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I guess the other issues, and if we look at the broader drivers of success, so that is things like rising inequality, social isolation or lack of cohesion, discrimination, uncertain futures, climate change. These are the things that young people have told us is driving distress. So not social media itself. Yeah, we've heard time and time again from the young people we talk to that what they actually want is safety online. So it's about kind of age-appropriate algorithms and, regulating harmful content online. It's the things that go on to make young people who might already be feeling distressed to go on social media and then amplifies the distress. It's that kind of regulation. It's the content that's available already that needs regulation. So the issues are much broader, and we just simply don't think that you can ban away a youth mental health crisis.
And you mentioned again earlier the debate yesterday and the result that the social media ban policy has been, I guess, put on hold for the moment. What's your take on that decision, if you could expand a little bit on what you said earlier, and how do you reckon the government should look at the ban moving forward?
We think there's a multi-prong approach here that's needed. So it's not just about choosing between doing nothing or implementing a blanket ban. We want to see basically any solution on online harm to include genuine involvement with young people as digital experts. A lot of these decisions are being made by generations that aren't actually online as much as young people are. Young people will tell you what's unsafe and safe if you ask them when they're in these spaces. We also think we want, access to adequate education, digital literacy and critical thinking for young people to support them when they're navigating online spaces, including resources for parents and whānau and guardians to actually normalise some of those online safety attitudes. So I know that there is work included in the new education curriculum that's looking at digital literacy, so that's quite a good action that's been taken by this current government. And then the final thing we'd want to see wrapped around this is stronger regulation for social media companies. So it is about holding them to account for the content. So they do need to carry, tech companies need to carry more responsibility, and safety should be built into the platforms from the start with stronger moderation, better reporting systems and age protections and less addictive design. So those are sort of the other potential policy options there.
That was Director of Wellbeing, System Leadership, Data and Insights at Te Heringa Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Dr. Ella Cullen, speaking to me about a potential social media ban in New Zealand.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Lobby Reform NZ recently put forward a petition to the government asking for three changes that would improve transparency around lobbying. These changes have been compared to some introduced in New Zealand's international counterparts, which allow members of the public to assess with greater accuracy how different politicians are being influenced. In New Zealand, the legislation around lobbying is relatively lax, leaving the public almost entirely in the dark. To discuss the petition and the scale of lobbying in Aotearoa, I spoke to Ben Wright from Lobby Reform NZ. I wanted to start off by talking about, I guess, the background context behind your petition. What is the scale of lobbying in Aotearoa at the moment? Do we even know, I guess, how much lobbying is going on?
No, exactly. That's the problem. And one of the things that MPs will bring up is defining what lobbying is. And that's where you can't really quantify what lobbying is, because is lobbying a local mum and pop operation who are talking to their local MP in order to get something changed on their street to help with their business? But what we want to focus on is the big lobbying firms which are employed by major sectors, whether that be in the oil industry or tobacco or, you know, a variety of different industries that could be quite healthy for the government to think about the kind of things that they want to put forward. So we just have no idea of what the scale of it actually is, and we're not going to know until we start putting these definitions in place.
And what are the kinds of organisations that are doing big lobbying? What are the views that are getting, I guess, going directly to our politicians and influencing policy?
I mean, it's a really tricky thing to cover, because sometimes you want your MPs to be talking to a wide range of different sectors because they just don't understand how the electricity sector works and they need to be informed. But, I mean, you're going to have lobbying from all sorts of corporations, whether it be, as I said, oil, tobacco, or one of the ones that we want to look at and see how much influence they're having on the government decisions, especially since the current government has decided to backtrack on some of the stuff that Labour put in. But, yeah, I mean, it is going to be from everybody in every area. And the idea is we're not looking to restrict people's access to MPs to talk about them. We just want some transparency around who is talking to whom, and then that might help us understand where the influence on certain decisions in government are coming from.
And if you could, I mean, you mentioned a little bit of it there, but could you go into what are the three big proposals that you're putting together in this petition that you've taken to government?
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to focus on making a mandatory lobbying register. So that will essentially make a publicly searchable database of all lobbyists and lobbying groups. So what we mean by that is there are companies that their sole purpose is to lobby on behalf of people who have the money to employ them. But we also know we want to take into account the lobbying portion of a major multinational corporation or even just a sector that has a lobbying division that they all sort of fund. The other thing that we would like is a meeting disclosure. So we just want the meetings that are being had between who and what the topic is about to be available to people. And then one of the other things that we're looking for is a 1 to 3 year stand down period for politicians who are leaving the political world. It's very easy pipeline to go from politician to lobbyist. And essentially that means that they can sell their political information as an employment perk, as it were, for getting them on board with a lobbying group. And then that means that they have an inside track onto what the government are doing or planning on doing. So by creating that 1 to 3 year stand down, it just means that we can prevent that from happening.
And I want to talk about some of those a bit more in depth. But first, I want to, talk about where New Zealand stands in the global situation around lobbying. How does New Zealand's lobbying legislation compare right now to our international counterparts? And how do these proposals compare to international counterparts as well?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is essentially it's a global thing which has been moving forward in many different countries, and New Zealand is way, way behind on a lot of these different areas. So the UK, for example, they have a mandatory lobbying register already, which says who the lobbyists are, who they represent, and what issues they're lobbying. We don't have any of that. We don't have any of the things that we're asking for, a meeting disclosure or a 1 to 3 year stand down. There are countries like Canada, essentially all the most of the countries in the OECD agreement, they've got essentially just any level of lobbying transparency that New Zealand just doesn't have at the moment.
How common is it for MPs, ministers, and then people in the lobbying industry as well to swap jobs? How common is it for someone to be doing this job for an extended period of time and then just immediately go into the other one?
I mean, it's quite common. I mean, if you just think about it in terms of, what would you do in a situation? There's no slight against MPs wanting to keep food on the table when they leave a political arena. And, some politicians, they're essentially, they might not find themselves in a job anymore just due to the voting circumstances. So they want to have a way to be able to keep being involved in the political side of things and advocate for things that they perhaps support. And becoming a lobbyist is a very easy pipeline to go for because essentially, the lobbying companies that will employ them, they want the inside information, and it's just an easy jump from politician to lobbyist in order to keep the funds coming in for their family. So we totally understand why that pipeline is there, but it only is there because we haven't thought about the kind of impact that has on our government.
While a lot of the changes are targeted at increasing transparency around lobbying, they don't seem to have, any material impact on the amount of lobbying that takes place. Does that worry you? I mean, that these changes could go in place and while we'd know that a bunch of lobbying is happening, we wouldn't have anything to do about it?
Well, we're not really looking to reduce lobbying. We just want it to be clear to people who is lobbying for what. I don't think there's no easy way of determining how much influence these big corporations has on our government at the moment, whereas in other countries, there's a lot of things that have been put in place to make that happen. So we're not trying to prevent lobbying from happening. We just want it to come to the surface so that it's a bit clearer, it's a bit more honest, and people can go into voting in the election feeling a little bit more informed. Also, I feel like it brings a confidence in the government. If the government are willing to have this level of transparency, then it means that there's a lot more confidence in who they're voting for, why they're going to vote for them. And essentially, we want that kind of confidence back in our government, especially with the state of global politics at the moment. We want to see that New Zealand can meet the standards that other countries are getting to in terms of transparency around lobbying.
That was Ben Wright from Lobby Reform NZ speaking to me about a petition to government aimed at increasing the amount of transparency around New Zealand lobbying. You can find more information about the petition in a link on this interview's BCast.
That was The Wire.
Ko ere te hau taka katoa mo tēnei wiki, me te mihi ki a koutou katoa e korere mai ki moa mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahine Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Simon Court, University of Auckland lecturer Dr. Justin Sobion, University of Auckland Professor of Commercial Law Gehan Gunasekera, Director of Wellbeing, System Leadership, Data and Insights at Te Heringa Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Dr. Ella Cullen, Lobby Reforms New Zealand, Ben White. Nā rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.